And welcome back to Dads on the Air, coming to you around Australia on the Community Radio Network. In this program, we bring you informing and entertaining conversations with a wide range of interesting people on topics of fatherhood, family and parenting, men's and boys' issues. Hi, I'm Bill Cable, and our special guest today is Barry Cassidy. Barry is well known to everyone in Australia, a political journalist. He's host of the ABC's highly respected discussion program, Insiders, and he's the author of his third book, Private Bill in Love and War. Welcome to the program.
Thanks, Will.
Barry, you are so well known to us as a political commentator that it comes as a surprise, I suppose, to know that you have an insider story about your own family. In your book, you describe how your father Bill's character was tested in Love and War, and in both cases, it was unusual. Starting with the war story, your father enlisted in July 1940. What do you think his reasons were for enlisting?
He was young and he was fit. He'd only just married. He did have a young child, and he had to take that into account. But he lived in the country, he lived on a farm, and I just think there was this sense of responsibility that maybe country kids had that not all city kids shared. But his father had served as a sergeant in the First World War, and I think it was once that France had been invaded that my dad decided that what was going on the other side of the world was very serious indeed, and I think in the end it was a rather powerful sense of responsibility that drove him to enlist.
So it was really for a noble cause, you think, rather than just a sense of adventure or anything like that?
Yeah, and there was always the prospect that was being talked about just before he enlisted that Britain might be next, and of course it was about 3 months later, and that kind of vindicated, I think, justified his decision. But he had a sense, and you've got to sort of throw back to how the mindset would have been back in 1940, and there was a real fear that this would impact firstly on Britain and then by extension Australia.
So he arrived in Crete on Anzac, actually, in 1941, just before about 15,000 German paratroopers. But he had an unusual way of becoming a prisoner of war, didn't he?
He stood under that parachute invasion in Crete, which is the only large-scale parachute invasion in wartime history, and that would have been both an awe-inspiring but horrendous experience, because those guys just were lambs to the slaughter. 15,000 of them, as you said, and so many of them lost their lives in that way. But he survived that invasion, but he was helping some British soldiers move a Bofa gun. That gun was hit from the air. He was wounded. He eventually went to a Red Cross centre and then on to one of the most unusual hospitals you'd find anywhere. I haven't been able to find a precedent for it anywhere. But by just circumstance and arrangement, the Germans and the Allies had agreed to share a hospital. And so depending on where you were in the queue as an injured soldier, you would be treated by a German surgeon or a British surgeon or whatever. That's the situation he was in. And, of course, when the war was over, the Battle of Crete was over within about 8 or 9 days, the Germans just simply walked into into that makeshift hospital one day and said, your mates have gone. You're now a prisoner of war. So he wasn't so much captured. He was kind of just transferred from freedom to captivity.
Yes, well, as a 29-year-old, as he was at the time, he saw all these terrible things. Did your father speak openly about his experience? Because a lot of war veterans seem to bottle it up for a long time.
And he was in that category. Look, we were all young. The five boys came after the war in fairly rapid succession. My sister was born before the war and then five of us afterwards. And, of course, we'd sit around and have these discussions, and I remember a program called Biggles would be on the radio, and that would get you thinking about war. And one of us might say to Dad, you know, can you tell us what happened in the war? Or you'd ask really, you know, juvenile and uncomfortable questions like, did you kill anybody in the war? And I think my dad just made a judgment for a long time that we weren't mature enough to really discuss it. And it was such a complicated thing in his mind. Where does he start? And what we didn't appreciate is that Mum didn't want a discussion about the war years either, and we didn't come to appreciate the full significance of that until much later. But I think it was just that attitude, and Dad just let it drift. And not only that, but he never joined in Anzac Day activities. I think he felt that because he was a prisoner of war for more than 4 years, and he he somehow got himself caught up in this attitude that he thought that people might think that prisoners of war weren't real ex-servicemen, that they somehow didn't fight and earn their credentials. And so he just chose to stay out of it. And that was the case and right up until maybe the 1980s.
And I think that's very real. I've discussed it with a few people whose fathers were in the army, and you know, it's a terrible thing. But there is that feeling that POWs perhaps weren't in the front line of fighting, and they were different. And I can understand your father feeling that way.
Yeah, and in fact, he endured more pain and suffering than a lot of soldiers who would have been on the front line for years. They had incredible pain, and the isolation and the and to be locked away for all those years without any sense of who was going to win the war and what might happen afterwards, it would have been, you know, mentally a terribly scarring experience. But nevertheless, that's the attitude that he adopted when he got home.
And do you think he discussed it with other people? I mean, as a portent to what was to develop in your own life, you were neighbours with Jack McEwen in those days. And do you think he might have discussed it with someone like John McEwen?
I think he would have, but only briefly, because they wouldn't have seen a lot of each other after the war. You know, there was a prisoner of war who shared a prison with him in Austria, who lived 5 miles down the road, and he never made any effort to go and see him. He didn't go to reunions. So it seems as if he just wanted to lock it all away. He didn't really want to talk about it, and that's what made it so extraordinary when eventually he did decide to open up, and I think it was a real healing experience for him.
So was it sort of like the dam breaking? I think he opened up initially to your brother, didn't he?
Yeah, it wasn't like a dam at all. It was just a gradual thing. He, as we got older and we were sort of in our late teens and obviously ready to talk about it with some sense of maturity and a bit more knowledge, a couple of my brothers would go out chopping wood with him into the bush around Chilton. And that's when they just sort of started talking about it, and he would start bringing up isolated events and one after another. And eventually, by then I was a cadet journalist in Albury, and when they told me he was starting to talk about it, I just put aside 3 days. And I said, right, I'm taking this opportunity. And I sat down at the kitchen table with him day after day, and we had lots of breaks and things, but we just went through it from beginning to end. And he was, a couple of times he broke up, he found it really hard talking about certain incidents that had occurred. But eventually we got it all down, and I wrote those words, about 2,000 or 3,000 words, maybe 3,000 words, for the family only. And it sat that way for about 20 years until one day I was persuaded to write a column on the ABC Drum website, an Anzac Day column. And so I wrote about my father, and I got 2 book offers out of that column. And so that's when I went back and did the full research and wrote the book.
Yes, I was wondering what drove you to put in print this this very personal family story. But the detail you go into when talking about the war is not something I've seen really in other books. I mean, it's a very detailed account. I mean, and some of it is quite grisly, you know, when he was removing a body off the road and worrying whether the body might come apart in his hands. I mean, things like that are just terrible.
Yeah, so much of that was what he told me, and we spent a lot of time doing. But then I went to Austria and I went to Crete, and then I got into the archives, and the archives are remarkable. If you just know where to look, it just fills out all that information that he spoke about. And then went and to be in places like Crete, and he was held in this castle for about 3 months. It was a fairly horrendous kind of a place. But I found it, and it's just as it would have been in the 1940s. And there was he described the farm, the mill beneath it, the stream, and a house on the right-hand side. And he said, that's all there was apart from the forest. And it was exactly like that. And just to stand there and kind of, you know, alone and just get a sense of what it must have been like for him. So that's how, you know, in the end I was able to really personalise it too and sort of try and get inside his head.
And how badly did the Germans treat POWs? I mean, we hear a lot about the Japanese treatment of POWs. Was the German treatment just as bad?
Yeah, the Austrians, he spent a lot of the whole time in Austria, but there were German soldiers as well there, of course. He thought the Austrian civilian population, the guards, he had a great deal of time for them. And when he was working in the mountains, and it was in the middle of winter, and this was really dangerous stuff because people died. People died on the cattle trains on the way across, and that's simply because the Germans treated them so badly. So there was that aspect to it, and when they were near death, and he really thought his time was up in the mountains, and the Germans actually said to them, you know, you guys are simply not up to this. We think we'll get some Russians up here. So that attitude was there. It prevailed, and yet with others, and some of the guards were Germans, and Dad became quite close to them. And after the war, he was the first to reach out to the German immigrants when they arrived in Australia. So it was that kind of strange relationship, because he could see the evil, but he also saw a lot of good.
Another person in the book describes your father. He had a lot of tests of his character, and I guess one of those major ones would have been that while he was a prisoner of war and suffering in the way you describe, he was also worried about the Japanese coming down to Australia and his wife, your mother, Myra. So that would have been a further mental torture for him.
It was the lack of knowledge about anything that was the problem. They managed to secure quite a bit of information at times. As other prisoners arrived, they might have been better informed, particularly those who came from Italy. Dad managed to smuggle in enough gear to make a radio and pick up the BBC, and so for a while they got that sort of information. But basically, the Germans would fill their heads with propaganda about what was going on back home, and that was one regular taunt that the Japanese were on the cusp of invading Australia, and by the time you got home, your wife would be married to a Japanese.
It eventually came to an end. In August 1945, he was back home, and he landed in Sydney and then went down to Melbourne for the reunion with your mother. I was just wondering if you could describe what that reunion was like when he eventually saw Myra again.
Yeah, it would have been very awkward at first because it was 4 years. They were young, and also with his daughter, Pam, who was, about 15 months old when he left, so she was 5 or 6. He would barely recognise her apart from the photos that Mum would have sent, but so he arrived at Spencer Street Station. John McEwan was there to meet him, and in fact gave him his government issued car for the day, and then disappeared. He said, "This is your day, Bill. Enjoy it." And so they did have this awkward embrace, but they knew straight away. That both of them have told me that they knew instantly that they could absolutely pick up from where they left off. And then they went to Paran, and the whole street came out. Dad had 7 sisters who were there that day. Seven sisters who were, you know, aged from about 8 to 15 when he left. So you can imagine, you know, 4 years on, 5 years on almost, they changed so much at that age. And he said he was in tears because he looked around and he couldn't immediately be sure that he could put a name to the sisters, because one looked more like the other when he left, because they'd put on 4 or 5 years. You know, the 8-year-old was now 13 and just looked so different. And that really hurt him at first, but I think in the end he thoroughly enjoyed the day.
Yes, we're going to take a short break now. This is a song by Joe Cocker. I think it describes Barry Cassidy's father. It's from the movie An Officer and a Gentleman, and it's called Up Where We Belong.
Oh,
And that was Up Where We Belong by Joe Cocker. And we're speaking today with Barry Cassidy, political journalist, host of the ABC program The Insiders, and the author of his third book, Private Bill in Love and War. So we were just talking about when your father, Bill, returned to Australia, and he got the train down to Melbourne, had the reunion with Myra and his daughter, and things progressed. He went on and had, five of you boys, I think, after coming back.
Yep, and as we often say, he had a very extraordinary, ordinary life. He moved to Chilton, where my mother was from, and just got involved in everything. He worked at the brickworks for very many years until that closed down, and then he was a sawmiller. So he worked very hard, pretty much on the basic wage, and bringing up kids would have been hard. But he got involved in all the sporting clubs because that's what we did, and became a much admired figure around town.
Yeah, I mean, he's described as a quiet and unassuming man. He's something of a role model. You hear about these some of these men, and you know, I must say, at the end of the book, I totally respected him, and you know, he's the sort of person you'd really want to meet. And I guess you feel the same way about your own father.
Absolutely, we're all very close to him, and you know, through this time, my mother's behaviour just struck people as strange in the sense that she would never leave home. And I mean, quite literally, she'd be virtually a prisoner in her own house. We lived 50 metres, 100 metres from all of the shops in the main street, and she would never go down to the shops. She wouldn't go to the football, or even though she was quite religious, she wouldn't go to church. And we just kind of put it aside as maybe she had a shyness, almost a psychopathic shyness or something. And so it annoyed us, but we just simply didn't think enough about it, and we put it to one side. And of course, 50 years after the war, almost to the day of the 50th anniversary of the Battle of Crete, but a letter arrived in the mail, and my mum and dad were out on the front lawn, and this letter was addressed to Mum, which was unusual then. And she went inside and she'd reading the letter, and then Dad came in and he could see that her hand was trembling. She was visibly upset, and he said, "What's in the letter?" And she didn't say anything, and he said, "Who is it from?" And she just looked up at him and said, "Look, I'm really sorry. It happened so long ago. It's from a guy called Richard. He thinks that he's my son, and I know that he is." Mm. And it was through that, the adoption laws that allowed, you know, adopted kids to eventually trace their parents and then make contact with them. And so her secret, which she'd kept only to one brother and sister-in-law all of those years, nobody else knew about it, and they died. And so she, in fact, held that secret on her own. And at that age, you know, they're both around their 80s, and to have to deal with that kind of situation. So that's why I say when Dad was tested a second time, that was it. That was the test.
I guess the worst part is holding it in for 50 years. It's just hard to imagine, isn't it?
And there's a certain strength about that as well. And then the way that they both dealt with it, I think, showed strength on both their sides. I mean, Dad was very upset, and he was for quite a while, for quite a few days. And then one of my brothers and sister-in-law came around one day, and he just said, "Look, I think it's time we dealt with this." And he just went to Mum, and he put her arm around her and said, "We've got to sort this out. This guy, he wants to meet you with you. I think you should. And I'll go with you, if that helps." And he did, and did several more times after that. And they confronted it. And, you know, in the end, Dad understood Mum's position. You know, here she was. What I didn't mention earlier is that when Dad went missing, the records were so lousy that for almost a year, Mum, the first telegram said missing in action, and the second said wounded and missing in action. And then for a year, she didn't know whether he was dead or alive. I mean, as I said to my mother at the time, you just couldn't script circumstances that more justified your life, you know, that what had happened. And I think eventually I know that they came to terms with it. And because in a way that they'd been so tested in that way and came through it, that I saw more affection between the two from then on than I'd ever seen between the two growing up.
Did it affect the relationship with all the children, do you think, finding this out?
Well, it was always going to be interesting to see how everybody dealt with it and whether they would deal with it in different ways and whether some would be forgiving and others wouldn't. And we brought up a Catholic family, though some are lapsed, some are still quite devout. And so you never knew what the kind of the different attitudes would be in a big family like that. But in the end, everybody got behind it. You know, when I wanted to write this book, when I got the offer to write the book, both mum and dad had died, and I would never have considered writing about this while mum was alive, unless, of course, she'd go right ahead with it. But so I got them all together, and I said to them that I had this book offer, and I'm a journalist, but not only that, it's so much a part of Dad's story. His war story didn't end in 1945. He carried it with him to his grave, and this was such an important element of that. And so I wanted to include it in the book. And, you know, in the end, they all came around, varying degrees of enthusiasm, but they all came around and supported it. And once it was published, 100% now, none of them carry any misgivings about going ahead and doing it.
Well, the good bit about it, and I think one of the reviewers described it the affectionate way it's told, but it's clear that both your parents really did love each other, you know, all throughout from the beginning to end. So that's the, I guess that's the overriding consideration in all this.
Dad was absolutely devoted to Mum. I mean, we all knew that, you know, through our lives, and so that was. It became a much bigger shock. Like what he did say to her is that what he can't understand is how two people as close as they were, how one could keep a secret like that from the other. It was more the keeping of the secret, strangely enough, than it was the affair that occurred during the war. But he came to terms with all of that because he eventually understood. Those adoption rules didn't exist until, I think, the late 70s or so, and so I guess Mum felt some comfort that it would never be revealed. I just imagine what she must have thought when she read that the laws were being changed. That she must have gone through privately and just on her own. She must have gone through so much anguish. When my mum sort of caught her breath, she decided she was going to phone all six kids one after another and just talk. And she wasn't really looking for forgiveness, but she was looking for some sort of understanding and just getting some sort of sense of what we thought. And I don't know where I was on the rundown, but it would have been the most expensive call. But that's when I said to her right away that, look, you couldn't script this, really. For so long, you didn't know whether Dad was dead or alive, and believe me, that's people are going to understand why this happened.
So we're talking about Barry Cassidy's book, Private Bill, In Love and War, and it really is a wonderful read in both aspects. So, Barry, we're at the stage of the program where I ask you to pick a song. Would you like to tell us which song you've picked and why you picked it?
Well, I think Lily Mullane, because I know that it's when Dad did open up about the war and then we started talking about it, it was that song that almost brought tears to his eyes. And I think, you know, it's a classic wartime song, but there were many of them. It was that one that seemed to have a special place in Dad's heart. And I know that he spent some time in London when they were finally repatriated before they were sent back to Australia. And that was a song that was just being heard up and down the streets of London.
So this is Lily Mullane.
Outside the barracks, by the corner light, I'll always stand and wait for you at night. We will create a world for two. I'll wait for you the whole night through. For you, Lily Mullane. For you, Lily Mullane. Bugler tonight, don't play the call to arms. I want another evening with her charms. Then we will say goodbye and part. I'll always keep you in my heart. With me, Lily Mullane. With me, Lily Mullane. Give me a rose to show how much you care. tied to the stem, a lock of golden hair. Surely tomorrow you'll feel blue, but then will come a love that's new for you, Lily Marley. For you, Lily Marley. Marching in the mud and cold, and when my pack seems more than I can hold, my love for you renews my might. I'm warm again, my pack is light. It's you, Lily Marlene. It's you, Lily Marlene. My love for you renews my might. I'm warm again, my pack is light. It's you, Lily Marlene. It's you, Lily.
And that was Lily Marlene, the special choice of Barry Cassidy, our guest today. So it just remains for me now, Barry, to thank you very much for being on the program.
Well, thank you very much for your interest. I appreciate it.
Don't forget, we'd love to hear from any of our listeners. You can go to our website, dadsontheair.com.au, send us an email and we'll be in touch. If you would like to listen to this show again or any of our shows, go to our website, dadsontheair.com.au, or you can follow us on Facebook or Twitter. So that's it for this week. We'll be back next week with another show on Dad's on the Air.